Hi, this is spoken word artist Tribal Rain.
And this is Max Parthas, host of New Abolitionist Radio, modern day slavery abolitionists. And you are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
And good morning. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Beth Pike, and I'm here on Monday morning. And today's broadcast is going to start with host Keith Brown-Ill. And he's going to be talking with Andrea James, and she is of Families for Justice as Healing. This Massachusetts-based group is a criminal justice reform organization that is advocating for community wellness, alternatives to incarceration, and reform of drug sentencing laws. In the second half of our broadcast, we'll be interviewing a rebroadcast from August, and that was in 2016. And our host then was Latara Smith, and she'll be talking with Keith Gibson, a local appellate lawyer, about the criminal appeals process and the appellate system on the federal and the state level. You'll want to stay tuned for the 420 Drug War news at the end of the show. But up next is Keith Brown-Ill and his guest, Andrea James.
Andrea James was released in 2011 from a federal prison for women in Danbury, Connecticut. She carried with her an organization she had established while incarcerated known as Families for Justice as Healing. I'm going to be interviewing her today by way of telephone here on Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Keith Brown-Ill. I'd like to welcome you and our guests to this morning's show. Good morning, Ms. James.
Good morning.
Could you please give us a brief description of your organization and what it does?
Sure. Well, there's a couple of things that we do. One, on a local level, the organization that you referenced, we started in the prison yard in Danbury, Connecticut, and carried that organization out as Families for Justice as Healing. That organization is a legislative and policy advocacy organization that focuses on the incarceration of women and girls and policy and legislative actions in the state of Massachusetts. And we also work on drafting and modeling policy recommendations that we share with our sisters in other states. For instance, we've worked on ending shackling of pregnant women during labor. If you can believe it or not, in this country, many states still will shackle an incarcerated woman if she is pregnant and goes into labor. During her labor and delivery, she will remain shackled to a bed. And we ended that here in Massachusetts in 2014. We drafted the primary caretaker legislation, which is a piece of legislation that would require a determination to be made if this person is convicted of a nonviolent offense. And we don't get into nonviolent versus violent. We can talk about that later, I guess. That was one of the concessions that we made to have the bill sponsored. But if a person has been convicted of a nonviolent offense, a determination must be made by the court if that person is a primary caretaker of a minor child. And if that is the case, consideration must be given to what else can be done other than incarceration so that we cause no further harm by separating mothers from their children. Women happen to be 85% of in state custody were the primary caretakers of their children prior to their incarceration. So it would have a deep and immediate impact on lessening that harm. So that's the kind of work that we do at Families for Justice as Healing. And that group, what grew out of that work that is still ongoing, we're challenging tainted drug lab cases here in Massachusetts, challenging the district attorneys and their unchecked power, and a number of other things, a new women's jail that they're trying to build. That's our work here in Massachusetts. What's grown out of that is a national network, a national public policy think tank of, for, and by incarcerated and formerly incarcerated women and girls. And the name of that national organization is the National Council for Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls.
I have to ask you another question. It's probably pretty obvious from the description you gave, but is your organization exclusively for women, or does it seek to help men or anyone else who has been incarcerated?
Yes. I'm married to a man, for instance, who served a 10-year federal mandatory minimum drug sentence many years ago. And of course we love our brothers, and of course we care about our brothers, and all of our work is to also support and to decarcerate and to change things on behalf of our brothers. But the fact of the matter is, women and girls, in the increase of incarceration has been more than 650% in this country, predominantly of black women, and it has gone unmentioned. It has gone with very little focus and very little light shown on that very particular issue of the very damaging effects that incarceration of women and girls in our communities have had over the past 25 years. And to have such a dramatic increase, we are the fastest growing incarceration population in this country. There really was no uplifting and focus placed on this very dramatic shift that happened in this country that started incarcerating predominantly black women at such an incredibly alarming rate. And we knew, as those women, when we sat in that prison in Danbury, Connecticut, and we organized ourselves first into Families for Justice as Healing, we knew that we needed to speak up and speak out on behalf of ourselves. So our focus, unapologetically, is on ending incarceration of women and girls. That's our goal, and it does focus on the issue of incarceration and the effects that incarceration has on our children and our communities, the incarceration of women and girls. So our organization is, first and foremost, a membership of incarcerated and formerly incarcerated women and girls. Women and girls who understand firsthand what it is like and what the very bad criminal justice policies in this country have had on us as women and girls. But everything that we work on, albeit that we raise the voices and raise awareness of us as women, and we unapologetically advocate on behalf of women and girls, everything that we do, because really women, particularly black women, are on the last rung of the ladder when it comes to all of the things that have been so bad, economic policy, social justice policy, that have affected us as a community, that if we do everything we can to uplift black women and girls, and women and girls in general, poor women and girls, we will uplift our entire communities.
I agree. Now, some of the ideas that you talked about in the first question that I had asked about shackling pregnant women to beds while they were in labor and exploring other options other than incarceration for nonviolent crimes, are these ideas that were developed by your organization, or did they come about as a result of you trying to form an alliance with other organizations around the country?
Oh, absolutely. Everything is about creating those alliances. So, for instance, we drafted the primary caretaker bill. So that initiated out of our organization from the hearts and minds of incarcerated and formerly incarcerated women who knew that going to prison wasn't the answer for them and their children. It caused more harm. Bills like the shackling bill and ending incarceration in general and all of these other things, ending the increase in the numbers of women's jails and prisons that exist, all those things have been, we have a long, long history of women who have been at the forefront of civil rights, of economic justice, of all of these things that directly impact women and women in the criminal legal system who have been affected. So we stand on the shoulders of all of these women, incredible, incredible women, some who have passed on, many who are in the fight, in the struggle across this country, in cities and states across this country, who we have just decided, though, that we are going to actually raise the level of awareness about the work that women are doing in this arena and also raise our voices and add our voices, not to talk about the messy parts of our lives that landed us on a prison bunk, because we're still, even within the criminal justice reform or what we call prison abolitionist movement, we are still, as women, not really a part of that conversation. It has been mostly dominated by men, and that is necessary and that is good. But there are also very gender-specific issues that need to be addressed by the women who have experienced those things. And so we stand on the shoulders of the women that forever, for years, for decades and decades and decades, through the civil rights struggle, through so even prior to the actual 60s, during the 50s, during the 40s, who did this work to create change from the voice of women. And some things we, as an organization now that we do legislative and policy advocacy, we draft and we shape. But it all comes from the energy and the brilliance and the sisterhood of women that have come before us and worked on all of these issues. And we are constantly reaching out to women to tell us, what have you done? What do we need to learn? What do we need to know about the work that has already been done? We certainly are not ever going to be the beginning of this work. I mean, Harriet Tubman was opening the doors and bringing our people home. So we certainly didn't start any of this. We are just making our voices louder and more connected so that we can be more effective.
Right. Would you mind telling us, what did you go to prison for?
I went to prison for wire fraud. I was primarily a criminal defense lawyer, and I also started to work in the real estate conveyance sector, and my law office closed loans for banks. And if you want to talk about what is really criminal going on in this country,
yes,
we want to put somebody in a prison and disappear them for years for having the illness of addiction or struggling with poverty. And we turn a complete blind eye and continue to invest our money and create deposits and open bank accounts that support these very nefarious and intentionally criminally minded banks and the things that they do and have done and continue to do to first exclude us, to redline our communities from even offering us opportunities that are offered to other communities throughout the country to bring ourselves up. And then after deciding that they could do even better by creating products that are so predatory and so criminal in nature, such as what happened recently during the real estate mortgage crisis that this country just saw, that banks got bailed out of. And I made some very poor choices. I come from a community. My children are the fourth generation to live in the home that we live in Roxbury, Massachusetts, an African-American community with deep, deep roots in the city of Boston. And when you take a home from a family that has been in this community for generations, where we raise our children, where the grandmothers are the caretakers while the parents work and go to school and try and make a better life for their families, you're not just taking this brick and mortar or this shingled home. You're taking a legacy from a family. You're taking deep roots from a community. And this is in communities all across Boston. That's how we live in this city and many communities across the country. And when predatory lenders sweep into our community, after we have already are standing and fighting against a war on drugs that was targeted just in our communities, when you now layer on top of that economic oppression and predatory lending, you now are throwing a second punch to a community that is already struggling to stay up from a very nefarious war on drugs. And I made some very bad decisions in my actions. I should not have done it. Even though I represented banks in closings, I began to feel very adverse about that because I started to recognize how the mortgage products themselves became more predatory and more criminal in nature, and that the bank was doing nothing about stopping this. And so I made some choices that were wrong. They were unethical. They were illegal. I had a fiduciary responsibility to protect my clients that happened to be banks. Every day I was in the criminal courts defending my clients and my community residents, which was the heart of my practice as a criminal defense lawyer. But I closed loans for banks, and that work became my downfall. And I made some incredibly bad choices, and I should not have done it. Regardless of how I felt about those entities, I still have a fiduciary responsibility to my clients, and I failed at that. I self-reported my offenses, and I was actually sentenced to serve a 24-month in a federal prison in Danbury, Connecticut. And I have to tell you that with all of the years, I had worked within the criminal justice system prior to that. I was an older woman. I was not old, but older. I went to prison at 45. And even I had worked within the criminal justice system for about 25 years prior to my incarceration. And this is what I try and tell people who are professionals doing this work. You are the professionals, but you must make room for the people most affected because we are the experts. It was not until even years of working within the criminal legal system that I walked into that prison for women in Danbury, Connecticut, leaving my own children. I had adult children, and I also had two babies still at home, my 12-year-old daughter, who's currently a sophomore at Spelman. And I, at that time, at 45, had just had my last baby, my baby boy, who now is 7. But when I left them in that parking lot and walked into the prison in Danbury, Connecticut, and surrendered myself to serve my sentence, it was just like a kick in the stomach. Because you don't become an expert at what needs to be done and how it needs to change until you've actually had that experience.
Okay, that's very enlightening. My next question to you was going to be, what kind of person were you before you went to prison? But I think you pretty much answered that. So what I want to ask you now is, what kind of person do you think you are in the present after having this experience of being incarcerated?
Well, you know what? I think really, you know, I grew up in an educator activist family, what I call. I mean, my parents were civil rights folks. They were researchers of people of African diaspora. As a child, we traveled the world learning about our people in other parts of the world, including right here in the United States. We heard the history of my grandparents and my parents, and within their work, within the civil rights struggle, and holding down our families in this community of Roxbury, Massachusetts. So I grew up in this culture of fighting on behalf of disenfranchised and marginalized folks. And I became a criminal defense lawyer because of that. You know, my uncle was the first black tenured professor at UCLA in California, and he was a labor lawyer, an expert on the Constitution. And so I grew up always knowing that I would be a lawyer. And I think that when I practiced law prior to my incarceration, I did it from a place of kind of with the appropriate gloves on, kind of with staying within the system, and kind of with falling in line with that framework that is set up. Post-incarceration, the gloves came off, because there was absolutely, after that experience, no way that I could continue to try and work within a system that needs to be completely dismantled, and that there is no reforming of our current criminal legal system. We need to completely shift out of that focus to a system of human justice. And that is a very different system than the current one that we have. So that's really the difference between then and now.
I agree with you 100%. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Keith Brownhill, and I'm speaking with Ms. Andrea James from Families for Justice as Healing. Now, you spoke a while ago about how it felt when you had to begin your incarceration. What kind of impact do you think this had on your children?
People don't think about, when you send a woman to prison, is she breastfeeding her child? What are the rights of the child to continue to have that relationship with their mother? My baby boy was 5 months old. 5 months. One day, he was able to be in my arms and to feed and to be nurtured directly, and to have my smell and to be close to me. And literally the next day I was gone, and I was 3 hours there and 3 hours back away in a completely different state where I could not see my son on a regular basis. I could not hold him. I could not be with him. I'm sure psychologically there's always some kind of drawback to that we never know what kind of trauma that may have caused my 5-month-old baby boy. Who knows? Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure that it did, though. I'm sure that he woke up the next morning wondering, where is this person that I'm so accustomed, that I lived inside of and I grew and was born out of, who is now gone from my life? That concerns me every single day. In addition to that, I had a 12-year-old daughter who was just coming into adolescence. And girls who are the daughters of incarcerated women are the most targeted for trafficking. They are the most targeted for high school dropout. They are the most underrepresented and undernurtured and underprotected children. I was lucky. I had a family that surrounded my children. I had a husband who brought my children to see me every single week that I had a visit. He was there in that visiting room bringing my children to see me. My children were protected. They were loved. But the reality is that the 99% of the women that were incarcerated and surrounding me, they were not so lucky. I was a lawyer. I got to self-surrender when it was time for me to check into the prison. My family drove me in a caravan and took me to the front gate to the prison and helped me to surrender myself. Many of the women, most of the women, they had not seen their children for 6, 7, and 8 years. Remember, this is federal prison where everybody was doing a mandatory minimum 10-year sentence. The feds don't care. Some of them, they were from thousands of miles away. Their babies, if they even knew where they were, because we have laws in this country that allow children to be adopted away from their mothers if they have been separated from them from a period of time. It is a horrific fact that currently exists in this country, and they have a nerve to call it the Safe Adoption Act. But the fact of the matter is, I was surrounded by women. I had to figure out, of a 24-month sentence, how to make it every day through 18 months. I was in prison with women who had already been there 18 years, and they were still had 18 more years to go, or 10 years, or some were serving life for nonviolent drug offenses. It was so incredibly outrageous. And if you don't understand, we look at our communities now and we see our boys with their pants sagging and everything, and we shake our heads and we want to blame them. We're afraid in our own communities about the gun violence that's happening, but we don't ever stop to understand how systemically this was created to happen to us, and that we have not risen above using our voices to bring an end to this. And we've got to recognize the connectivity of these issues. Gun violence in our communities is directly related to mass incarceration.
Yes, it
is. And all of the social issues that have grown out of cycling in and out of incarceration and the carceral state and the policies that oppress us in our communities that are criminal legal policies that directly impact the health and well-being of the people of our communities. We know it's true. We know it was nefarious. We know it was intentional. And now we have to understand how to connect the dots. And, you know, I was just thinking about this, and I'll be quiet in a second, but I just wanted to mention, I was reading this incredible book, Hands on the Plow, which are the stories of the sisters in SNCC, who were the untold stories of the women in the civil rights movement that were members of SNCC that really contributed to the change in this country. And I asked myself when I was finishing that book, what is it about now that so many people in our community are so indifferent or appear to not be engaged in bringing an end and ending today mass incarceration and the effects that it's having, the militarization of policing in our communities, the targeting of our young people, the circling of the blocks by drug detectives just on a hunt to constantly reincarcerate us, looking at the maps created by Eric Cador from the Mapping Project that demonstrate to us from across the country, from Boston to California, the intentional targeting of black and brown people from our urban communities in the war on drugs. And yet we are silent. We are complacent. We are complicit in this by not raising our voices. And I asked, what's the difference? Well, in the civil rights movement, it was all because of who we were as black people. But we have got to do a better job of helping black people today understand that this is the civil rights issue of this era. 6 million black men could not vote in this past presidential election.
Yes.
6 million due to felony voter disenfranchisement laws. Voting Rights Act is not a permanent document. If we don't understand the absolute necessity to wake up and pay attention to this issue and get engaged in ending this, we are going to find ourselves to be out of the right to vote as a people.
You were talking a while ago about some of the at-risk categories that black women are in, and you didn't mention anything about premature pregnancies. Do you try to counsel women about the dangers of trying to become mothers too early in life, that this puts them at further risk of possibly being incarcerated or what can happen if incarceration occurs?
Well, again, we don't do a lot of direct service work. However, because we organize and mobilize ourselves and are constantly together from city and state to city and state across this country, we create those environments for those kinds of dialogues to happen. It does come up. We do a symposium series called Real Women, Real Voices. We've done it in 6 law schools across the country so far: Vanderbilt, Yale, Washington State, American University, Columbia, a number of the law schools. We do it at law schools in the hopes of developing relationships with them to help us on our policy work. But when we do that, we have usually 3 or 4 panels. We Skype in the voices of our sisters who are incarcerated in prisons who allow us to do that, and panels of formerly incarcerated women, again, not to talk about the messy parts of our lives prior to incarceration, but to use our voices to create more effective policy, to say from our experiences, here's what we recommend in terms of policy to create that real dramatic shift that needs to happen as the experts. And in that space, one of those panels, for instance, you know, is the family panel, where what we call our women who are our movement family, They may be our mothers. They may be our sisters, our aunts, or, you know, people in the community that have been on the ground who are fighting this battle with us. And a lot of times in those spaces, those issues come up that are about things that we need to think about as women. And because the National Council, that work is the National Council of Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls. So we have a youth leadership division within the National Council. And in those spaces, we always create those environments where we talk about those issues. And those, our daughters, those young girls, they're pregnant, some of them. They're struggling, or they've given birth and lost custody of children. And already at young, young ages, 18, 19 years old, they're struggling not only with the issues that led them to a prison bunk, but they're struggling with having lost the custody of their children already. And that's an incredible burden for a young person to live with. So we always, because of who we are and the spaces that we create to do our work, we are always addressing those kinds of issues.
It's evident that your incarceration had some type of positive impact on your perception of reality. Do you think that this was intentional by the system, or it was purely accidental, that a coincidence of you being incarcerated and being aware of your surroundings?
Well, I think it was intended, but it was more intended by the path that God lays out for you, right? So what is your path, and why do things happen in your lifetime? What are the lessons that we can learn from those experiences? What are the things that happen as a result of the path that we take? And if we choose to look at them only in a negative light and say, well, why'd that happen to me, and boo-hoo about it, and not be silent with ourselves and really try and focus that energy on what was the purpose of this experience that I just had? That's the first thing. The second thing is, I absolutely don't ever think that this was the intention of the system that incarcerated me. Because if it were the intention of them, they would be open arms with all of the recommendations and suggestions in our work to break down those walls and create more transparency and raise up the voices of the sisters that we left behind, which they fight against every step of the way. So our job is to really shed some light and break open those walls so that people can understand what is really going on inside of these prisons. And if they intended on raising my awareness so that I would use my voice to do those things, well, they sure certainly aren't acting like it. So it's a two-part question. The first part really is, this the path that I was intended to go down, and I embrace that, and I'm grateful for my experience, because it's necessary work. It has to be done. It's an injustice. It's a grave injustice that's happening in this country and really around the world. We're able to do a lot of networking and communicating with incarcerated women and formerly incarcerated women now globally. And we hear the same stories from black and brown women and poor white women across the globe. So incarceration has been used as a tool. Laws have been used as tools to oppress and incarcerate black and brown, in particular, predominantly black and brown people in this country. And, you know, I'm grateful that I had an experience that made it very crystal clear to me that that is the case, and that there's no question about it, and what needs to be done to create a radical shift to end that thing. And the system certainly, I don't think, anticipated that, from me anyway.
Well, let me be clear. When I asked you that question, I didn't seriously believe that it was the intention of the system to have this type of positive impact on you either. But it's a question that has to be asked, because, like, a lot of times when you read about things that are positive that people have done, you know, you have these officials, they step forth and take credit about you having your awakening in prison, and they'll try to claim that the system works. So we have to, when we do these type of interviews, we have to try to dispel that notion. I've spent a considerable amount of my time in prison as well, and it had a positive impact on me by coincidence or accidental. It wasn't the intention of the prison officials. That's why I had to ask that question. The next thing I want to ask you is, obviously there are some things in your life that you would have done different if you had the benefit of foresight. Now, could you elaborate on that a little bit for me?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, first of all, ethically, you know, I take full responsibility for what I did. But also, in light of doing that, I take full responsibility so that I am better positioned to talk about what was going on in this country that was further oppressing working class and poor folks in this country, which was very criminal and very nefarious. And being able to talk openly about that helps us as people in this country to understand that the focus that we put on the criminal justice so-called crime index that defines what is a crime in this country needs to shift. We need to have a different perspective. And so my experience of committing wire fraud within a very criminal and predatory banking industry, being able to openly talk about that as a crime, as something that was that I did that was defined as a crime in running banks and hedge funds, the things that they did weren't ever considered a crime. We can shine light and then raise awareness about what is a crime. We have to really start thinking about that, because most of the things that are filling the prison bunks, whether it's county, state, or fed prison, they're there for things that aren't criminal. They're there for things that we've essentially criminalized the illness of addiction and poverty in this country. And we've allowed that to happen. So we have to be able to have these transparent conversations about what people are in prison for. What is it? What did you do? And what was it? My actions landed me in prison. I lost the right to practice law. I was disbarred in the state of Massachusetts. And those things were tools that I had. That thing, being a member of the bar, was a tool that I had that I could have continued to use, but for my crime I was accused of committing and prosecuted and convicted of, I could still be doing this work in an even more expanded capacity. My actions took that away. So in reflection, there were definitely things that I wouldn't have done. I wouldn't have done any of the things that were defined as wire fraud that landed me in a U.S. courtroom and sentenced me to a federal prison. You know, it had dramatic and permanent consequences on my family and my ability to take care of my family in ways that I was able to do prior to this. Having said all that, it was an experience in my life, and I can't worry about being in regret of that. I have to take the experience and find the lessons in it and move forward.
Now, when you were disbarred, is that a permanent disbarment, or is there a chance that you could ever get your license to practice law back once you've completed your probation and the other requirements of having a criminal conviction satisfied?
Well, yes, I can petition for reinstatement to the bar, and I will. And I am finished with everything. I'm off paper now. I wrapped up 3 years. I did more probation, which is part of the issues that we're trying to raise, how the carceral state, it's not just about mass incarceration, it's about the carceral state. So I did more time on probation, federal probation, which is, you know, they eradicated federal parole. They made you do 85% of your sentence. And then somehow they strategically, even after you did that sentence, finagled away with some trickery to call something probation, which historically probation has always been in lieu of incarceration. So as far as I'm concerned, you're giving people in the federal system anyway a double sentence. And I did a longer sentence on probation than I even served in the prison. I had a 24-month prison sentence, not running consecutively, but after that, I had to serve a sentence of probation. Probation, the definition of it is in lieu of incarceration. So right. Why, you know, this is one of the things that we're challenging on the national level in our work at the National Council for Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls, that issue around federal probation. How dare you eradicate federal parole, take away the chances of somebody actually after serving 50% of their time, 55% of their time, get a shot at getting a second look and a chance to restart and get back out to their families and communities, and you eradicate all of that, bump the time up that you have to do to 85%, and then you sentence them again to a sentence in the community, because that's what it is, right?
Right.
And so I'm off of all of that now and will very soon petition. And there's a period of time. When you're disbarred as a lawyer, every state has their own rules and regulations around that. But in Massachusetts, it's an 8-year period that you have to be shut down for disbarment before you can, and it doesn't mean anything that just because your 8 years is up, that the time has told that you can actually ask.
Right.
You just can't ask before that, but it doesn't mean you automatically are reinstated. It's something you have to ask them to consider. It's absolutely discretionary.
Okay, I have just a couple of more questions I want to ask. We're almost out of time. One of the questions I want to ask you is that, do you feel that being disbarred has taken the restraints off of you from being able to openly speak about the corruption in the criminal justice system? Or did you feel you were under restraints at the time because of your career, and that saying certain things may have jeopardized your ability to be effective?
Yeah, it goes back to what I was saying before my incarceration, that I kind of worked within the system and had my gloves on, right? And
right.
So I was very careful about being politically correct. And, you know, even though I was a zealous advocate in the courtroom and went to the mat and fought on behalf of my clients, politically I had the gloves on. I think the difference is now, and the entire experience, I mean, when you're prosecuted and you only are able to have the prosecutor's side of the story, and that's what is publicized, and people who don't know you don't really understand why you do the things that you do. It's troubling, and it's painful. It's a painful process, and it's a deeply painful process. And anytime any of us goes through a deeply painful process like that and come out the other side, we're changed from it. And thankfully, I think I've been changed for the better. That disbarment, if I were to be reinstated, quite honestly, I would never be able to fit back into that box of political correctness. I would never be able to shrink down my voice, even if I were reinstated, to a place that would be back pre all of this.
That was the purpose for me asking you that question. Are there some things you would have done differently? Not necessarily to admit that you wouldn't commit the crime over, but I was thinking of along those lines, those very lines that you just articulated. Now, I have one more question. Could you please give us your contact information?
My name again is Andrea James, and I'm the executive director and the founder of Families for Justice as Healing. My email is the same for both, and the National Council for Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls. We have websites for both organizations, and my email address is ajames@healing, as to heal something, ajames@justiceashealing.org. And my phone number is 617-905-2026. You can check out our website for the National Council at theCouncil.us, theCouncil.us.
Ms. James, this has been very enlightening having this interview with you, and I am very delighted that we had this discussion. Best of luck to you in your endeavors, and we wish that people would take time out to try to listen to the message that you have to impart.
Thank you for inviting us. Thank you very much.
Now, the calendar for January 9th. Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters will have their monthly meeting Saturday, January 14th, from noon to 2 p.m. at the Waldo Branch Library, 201 East 75th Street, KCMO. If you have a loved one that is incarcerated and need advice and support, MISD has members that may be able to help. The Moore Squared Kansas Caucus and Advocates for Immigrant Rights and Reconciliation invites you to join them to a safe place of solidarity, protection, and commitment with and for our immigrant and refugee families in the bi-state area. They will be meeting Thursday, January 12th, 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the Overland Park Christian Church, 7600 West 75th Street, Overland Park, Kansas. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Up next is Latara Smith and her guest, local lawyer Kent Gibson.
Hi, my name is Latara Smith. I'm with the Casey Freedom Project, and today I'm your host on the Giles of Justice radio show. You're listening to KKFI 90.1 FM, and we would like to thank you for tuning in this morning. This morning, I have the privilege and the honor to interview a very, very well-known attorney here in Kansas City, Missouri. We are interviewing a Mr. Kent Gibson today. Mr. Gibson, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show with me today. I appreciate having you here.
I'm glad to help you out. Thank you.
Awesome. Mr. Gibson, can you tell us just a little bit about you? And I know that you're an awesome attorney, but can you tell us just a little bit more in specific about what you do and your legal expertise and maybe some of your educational experiences and things like that?
All right. I've been a criminal defense lawyer for the last 32 years. When I was a young lawyer, I was a public defender in Jackson County. Then I started working a lot on death penalty cases, a lot in the late 80s and through the 90s, when that was the death penalty was a lot more popular than it is now. And the last, I don't know, 15 or 20 years, I've sort of specialized in post-conviction litigation to try to, particularly in cases where I think the innocent have been convicted, which the DNA revolution has opened the eyes of a lot of people, that there are a lot more innocent people in prison than anybody in the public or even in the criminal justice system would like to admit. And it's still a very uphill battle to try to get an innocent man out of prison. It's a lot harder than it should be.
Right. Well, let me ask you something real quick, because you said something that a lot of our listeners may not know what that means. What do you mean by post-conviction relief?
Well, and post-conviction appeals are just what it means. After someone's convicted, you normally have what's called a direct appeal, where you challenge the fairness of your trial based on errors supposedly committed by the judge or the prosecution in admitting evidence or jury instructions, things like that. If you lose your direct appeal, then you have a post-conviction appeal, which is called in Missouri, we call it a 2915, where you usually litigate issues involving the effectiveness of your trial lawyer, or if there was some exculpatory evidence that wasn't disclosed, it would be claims that are outside of the record of the trial. And you should have an opportunity, although not always, to have a hearing and put on any additional evidence to support your claim that you were wrongfully convicted. Once that's completed, you have a right within a year to go into federal court to file what's called a federal habeas corpus petition. However, about 20 years ago, as part of the Anti-Terrorism Act, that in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing, they've really limited that remedy. It was designed to speed up death row appeals, but it applies to everyone, whether you have the death penalty or not, and it makes it very difficult for a federal court to overturn a state court conviction. So, and once you complete that process, you're pretty much done with your normal review. And if you're on death row, that's when you're likely to face a serious execution date. And your options, if you don't succeed on any of those appeals, are limited. And particularly the sort of perverse thing about it is both Missouri courts and the federal courts, particularly in this circuit, say you cannot raise a claim of innocence in a 2915 or in a federal habeas. It's only limited to whether you got a fair trial or something unconstitutional about your conviction. So that's really and it just underscores, I think, that there's not an adequate process in Missouri for courts to hear claims of innocence.
Right. And it doesn't appear to be. Most definitely not. It most definitely doesn't appear to be. Now, people don't understand that once, you know, that gavel is slammed down to that desk there and it comes, the conviction comes across as guilty or however they do it, it is quite a long process for, you know, people think, oh, I'm found guilty, I'm going to file my appeal, I'm going to walk out these doors out of my appeal, it's going to be turned around. But many, many, many times it does not happen like that. And people don't understand how much time it takes. You know, when we see cases where there's, you know, 10, 20 years of people fighting to get out, you know, this is reality with these post-conviction process. You know, I mean, what do you think could help that long time, all these years of litigation to be cut down. Are you familiar? I know I just asked you, what did you think could help it? But are you familiar with conviction integrity units?
Yes. A lot of major cities, prosecutors or district attorneys or whatever they call them in the particular jurisdiction have started these units, and they're basically, it's sort of like, the best analogy I can sort of think of is it's sort of like an internal affairs is to the police department. They're supposed to be insulated from some of the politics of the office, which everybody's got to keep in mind that prosecutors almost everywhere are politicians, and
right.
a lot of people we see is in Congress and the Senate got their starts as prosecutors, and so politics infects the whole, that issues of justice all the time, but particularly in the past with the tough on crime mentality that a prosecutor would be extremely hesitant, particularly if they have future political ambitions, to free someone who's been convicted if they think there's evidence of innocence, because their political opponents could use that against them. I think fortunately the climate is changing from probably at the height of the anti-crime hysteria and draconian laws that were in effect in the 90s, and I think a lot of people of all political stripes realize that we have a broken criminal justice system. But a conviction integrity unit would be a unit of prosecutors who all they do is review older convictions from that county or jurisdiction and determine whether they believe this person is innocent,
right,
and was wrongly convicted. And they would have the power to do something about it, which would be to order to agree to have the conviction overturned and either free the person or, at the very minimum, allow a new trial where all the evidence of the person's innocence could be heard. So far, at least in Missouri, which has never been on the forefront of anything progressive in my lifetime, and since I've been born and raised here all my life, there's no such thing in Missouri. But we're hoping that at least in Kansas City and St. Louis, they would be amenable to this, because I think it's really a necessary thing, particularly in light of what I mentioned earlier, that oftentimes the post-conviction review process in Missouri does not provide an adequate forum for someone to litigate their innocence in the courts. So I think that would be a very, very worthwhile thing to have in every major city, and
right,
for that matter, in every county in the state, although they wouldn't have the manpower to do that in smaller counties.
Right, right.
Perhaps the Attorney General's office could get involved in that sort of situation. But that's catching on, and I think it's in light of the fact that everybody knows now that there are some studies that say as many as, you know, 5 or 10% of everyone in prison are innocent.
Right.
And when you have that level of error, if it's 4 out of 100 or 8 out of 100, that's there's got to be something in the system to rectify these mistakes.
Right. Well, you know, that is one, you know, as an advocate for the wrongly convicted and having a very dear friend that's wrongly convicted and in prison, you know, pushing for the conviction integrity unit is most definitely something that, you know, I have 100% stood behind. And it was shocking to me when I came here to Missouri and began to speak with state reps and, you know, different individuals about conviction integrity units. No one knew about it. No one was familiar with them at all. And, you know, I would not have even known about a conviction integrity unit had I not had connection to the unit that was in Dallas that was established by Craig Watkins there. He has a very, very, he started a very successful conviction integrity unit that has been responsible for releasing several individuals there in Texas who were wrongly convicted. And, you know, we are hoping and praying that, you know, we will be able to, you know, get one of those units established here, because it's very important. It not only can cut back on some time, but it can also save some expenses, because many of the people that are wrongly convicted that are sitting in prison, you know, they already, you know, if you're lacking resources to have money on your books and get the things that you need in prison and make phone calls, and you're most definitely lacking financial resources to retain, you know, an attorney to fight all of this post-conviction and relief, because we know that it can be, you know, very costly. So we're hoping and praying and believing that our prosecutor's office here will be open, you know, to the implementation of a conviction integrity unit and be that lead, you know, be that lead for the other counties in Missouri to say, look, we took it on first and look what we're doing. Look at the difference that we're making in the lives of those that are here in Jackson County. Because, you know, you also have to understand that it not only costs the person who's wrongly convicted quite a bit of money to fight, you know, all of the post-conviction relief, but it costs us taxpayers a lot of money to house these people who are wrongly convicted. We're paying for nothing. And so I just see it could be a win-win for everyone, most definitely. Now, Mr. Gibson, do different circuit or district courts use different proceedings to inform their rulings?
Well, in Missouri, if you complete your normal post-conviction process and lose, then there's the only real avenue you have is the old common law writ of habeas corpus that Missouri follows. You have to start out and file in the circuit where you're incarcerated, and then you can take it to the Court of Appeals and then to the Missouri Supreme Court. The problem with it is that it's a totally discretionary writ, and
right,
the courts don't have to hold hearings. They don't even have to, in most cases, even issue a written opinion explaining why or why your case lacks merit or does have merit. They usually just issue one-line orders denying the petition, and that really gives you very little mechanism. You don't have the right to appeal. You just file it in the next highest court. And from my experience, it's frustrating, and I've seen it time and time again.
Right.
Is you'll have a very, very strong case. So you'll file a very detailed petition with a lot of affidavits and statements from new witnesses or witnesses who did testify, who admit they lied in court or were pressured by the police or prosecutors to lie. And you'll file the petition. I had one recently where I filed a very detailed case. All the witnesses against this man have recanted. I filed it in the Court of Appeals on a Tuesday afternoon.
Well, I've heard about
that. And by 10 o'clock the next morning, they'd issued a one-line denial. And it wouldn't have been humanly possible unless the court or their law clerks had pulled an all-nighter for them to have carefully reviewed this case. And it's maddening to think that someone in that situation would not get more of a fair process to prove their innocence.
Well, in a situation like that, because I most definitely know the individual you're referring to, what would be his next option?
Well, now, since he's lost in the Court of Appeals, the only place he has left to go is the Missouri Supreme Court.
Okay.
And At least they do not do that. And from my experience, all three of the intermediate Court of Appeals, the one in St. Louis, the one here in Kansas City, and the one in Springfield, the Southern District, I've had the same experience in all three of them. You could file a petition, and less than 24 hours later, it's denied in a one-sentence order with no explanation as to why they took the action they took. And then when they don't write an opinion, there's really nothing for a higher court to review. So it makes it a very you don't know whether they denied it on a procedural technicality or if they denied it because they weren't convinced that you had enough to prove your innocence, but there's no way of knowing, and you don't have any right to a hearing. And at the process at the circuit court level, there's a practice that is being challenged in the U.S. Supreme Court in a case that may be heard out of, I believe, Alabama or Florida, where the attorney generals prepare the orders for the judge to sign denying the petition. and it's just basically a rubber stamp. And the counties where prisons are housed, I think the circuit judges are pretty jaded, because they do get a lot of frivolous prison litigation, but I think because of that, they're not, it impacts the way they look at even guys who have very strong cases that they were wrongfully convicted, and they have what they call prison dockets, and one day a month they'll shoot through all these prisoner cases, and more often than not the attorney general will be asked to draft an order for the judge to sign, and that's what happens. And if ordinary civil litigants were treated the way convicts are in their challenges to their convictions, there'd be calls for impeachment of judges and
right.
all sorts of outrage. But of course, prisoners don't have lobbyists so like trial lawyers and corporations, and they can get away with a double standard of treating convicts unfairly when they try to challenge their convictions.
Right. Right. Well, everyone, you are listening to the Jaws of Justice radio show. I'm your host, Latara Smith of the Casey Freedom Project. Today, I am interviewing Mr. Kent Gibson. He is a local attorney here in Kansas City, Missouri. And we are just speaking on the subject of post-conviction relief and all of these different types of motions and things that are filed in order to help those who are wrongly convicted to have their issues addressed in court with the possibility of them being released from prison. So we thank you all for tuning in. Mr. Gibson, now, there has been quite a bit, you know, we've had a lot of people that have been being released throughout various cities. I mean, if you know, I don't know if you're on Facebook quite a bit, but it seems like every week you've got two or three people who their cases are being overturned. You know, we have individuals that are being released through conviction integrity units. We've had some, you know, prosecutors or judges that said, you know what, hey, you know, enough is enough. Reverse the conviction, you know. I mean, and we're seeing a lot of it, and I, you know, it's kind of, we're happy, but it's also kind of like, wow, what's going on when you see all these cases where individuals are in prison for 20 years, 25 years, you know, and they've been saying from day one, I'm innocent, I'm innocent, I'm innocent. And some of these are actually coming through, you know, from the other innocence projects and things like that. But a lot of them are coming as a result of the conviction integrity unit. So we don't have very, very we don't have a lot of time left. So I wanted to ask you, I want you to kind of recap a few things. And most definitely, I need you to give out your information in case we have someone listening that wants to contact your office for assistance with their loved one's case and wrongful conviction.
Yes, there was just a case in the Sunday Star today of a guy in Texas who was exonerated, and he's been in since the early 90s, and the prosecutors and the police pressured his co-defendants to lie on him because they were promised probation, and then as soon as they reneged on that and sent them to prison as well, they recanted. But it took him 23 years to be exonerated, which that's just unacceptable.
Did he come through a conviction integrity unit, or?
I don't think so. I know it was in Texas, but I don't think it was in Dallas. But
okay.
I think there ought to be a way, and I think either through the legislation or the Missouri Supreme Court can amend their rules of criminal procedure or post-conviction procedure to allow someone who has a claim of innocence to actually file a motion or a petition in the court that convicted him.
Right.
And have a hearing. And if that hearing is denied, or if post-conviction relief or a new trial is denied, he ought to have the right to appeal it to Missouri appellate courts. Without that sort of process, in Missouri, it's a crapshoot as to whether someone who's wrongfully convicted can get a fair hearing and get released. I think, for instance, the Ryan Ferguson case, the guy who's now got a new MTV show, I think if he hadn't come from a fairly prosperous family
and spent
a lot of money, and then also did a very extensive media campaign,
exactly.
He probably would still be in prison.
Right.
And of course, you know, it doesn't hurt that he is not a minority or someone
exactly.
from the city who has no resources and is a lot of people are languishing in prison and they don't have family or loved ones with the resources to attack the conviction. And the Innocence Projects through in Missouri and throughout the country do the best they can, but
right.
they're backlogged with these cases, and something needs to be done on a local level, particularly in the major metropolitan areas, to allow these cases to be heard and to be heard without someone having to languish in prison for 20 or 30 years.
Right.
Because the last person that I have gotten out was originally on death row and then serving a life sentence from a conviction that happened in the late 80s, and he got out about 5 years ago.
Right.
He was in prison for nearly 30 years.
Right.
And before he was exonerated, and that's just unacceptable.
Right, right. It is. It is. It really is. Well, Mr. Gibson, we want you to get your contact information out because we're nearing the end of the show, and I want people to have that information on you.
My name is Kent Gibson, and that's G-I-P as in Paul, S-O-N. You can reach me. You can either Google me and get all my information from my website, but my phone number is 816-363-4400. And my office is in Kansas City, Missouri, but I do cases all over the state of Missouri in state and federal court, and have actually even done some cases in a few other states. So, but it's sort of there are not very many people who do this type of work.
Right.
So most criminal defense lawyers, you know, go to court every day on relatively minor criminal sort of things, and I specialize in a lot more complex types of cases, and they can be time-consuming. It can take years to litigate one of these cases.
Right,
I've had clients now that I've represented for 10 or 15 years and are still
wow.
trying to get them out of prison. It's just it's a frustrating process, but every now and then justice prevails and something good happens.
Right, right.
It should happen a lot more often.
Right. Well, we would like to thank you for coming on the show. It's been a blessing to interview you today. Everyone, thank you for tuning in. JT&T for Life. Have a blessed day.
It's the 420 Drug War News. One of my guests last week on Cultural Baggage was the journalist, reporter, activist, Maya Salovitz.
I wrote an article like years ago that had the very silly premise of if everybody who'd ever smoked pot one day showed up and their face would be blue, prohibition would have to end that day because you would see like virtually the entire country.
yeah.
And, you know, I think really like a lot of the momentum behind the drug war in the past was that everybody was afraid to speak out because there was such a stigma and such a moral crusade against drugs and who wanted to like support giving drugs to kids and, you know, all of this kind of thing. So a lot of people had a lot more sensible views on policy even back in the 80s and 90s, but they thought everybody else was a drug warrior, so they were afraid to speak.
Yep.
And now sort of since the internet in particular and since, you know, you can go online and get information that is not propaganda about this subject, and you can actually look at the scientific literature for yourself. Once you have a source of clear information about this, and you also hear from other people who have been in the same situation, you start to realize, hey, like, my view is actually the one that makes sense, and, you know, I can speak about this. I mean, I think, you know, the gay rights movement and lots of other movements have shown the real value in people coming out and just showing, you know, hey, we are people, you know, like stigmatizing us for things that you don't like or things that you don't understand doesn't help anybody.
Well, friends, we've been speaking with Maya Salovitz. She's a journalist, an author. Her most recent book, Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction. Maya, is there a website, some closing thoughts you might like to share?
Oh, sure. So my website is just my first name and the first two letters of my last name. So it's MAIA, S like Sam, Z like zebra.com. where you can find lots and lots of my writing and information about my book. But I think the really most important thing is that, like, a good message around changing drug policy is recognizing addiction is compulsive drug use despite negative consequences. Negative consequences like prohibition, like police and locking people up and long sentences and all of this stuff are not going to solve a problem that is defined by resistance to negative consequences. So once we understand that, I think we can start to move forward towards better and more productive policy.
You can hear the full interview with Maya Salovitz by going to our website and checking out the Cultural Baggage Show for September 8th. Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
We hope that you have enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcast on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or you want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. This is Jeff Humfeld, and our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesdays, Alternative Radio on Wednesdays, a mix of national and local programming on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Dr. Mike's Morning Medicine Show, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio at 6 p.m.